into her cage and would not complain anymore. Soon, all the prisoners stopped complaining. Surratt Chestnut's cage faced what she believed to be the sea. She heard the waves breaking against the shore, just beyond the guard towers and a forest of leaning reeds. In storm season, when the sky overhead thickened and lit up, the waves rose high and crashed into the stone beaches. Other times, the waves were calm and made a sound like a dog slowly lapping from a bowl. Chained and unable to stand upright in her tiny cage, she strained to glimpse the water, but the sea lay beyond reach. In the first weeks of her captivity, she did not speak, neither to the guards who watched her, nor to the women nearby. The guards took her silence as a passive defiance, and often threatened to take her to the non-compliance area. The women, put off by her refusal to talk, began to suspect her as some kind of foreigner, perhaps a spy, or a blue banished to this place for treason. Instead, she listened to the sea. She nursed a broken rib suffered during the night the soldiers came to take her in Lincolnton. In time, the pain in her chest dulled and breathing became less difficult. But the weeks she spent crouching and sitting in the cage began to inflame her knees and her back. To remedy this, she knelt into a child's pose, which she held until Bud or one of the other guards came and ordered her to get up. She waited on death. She had no doubt that soon the troop of masked guards would come to take her, not to the non-compliance area, but to some courtroom in the heart of the blue. She imagined being led in, shackled, before rows and rafters full of indignant, jeering northerners. She imagined standing before the firing squad, a line of young soldiers no different from the ones who once hovered in Templestowe's eye. She imagined facing their softly trembling hands and smiling. Because no matter what they did with her afterward, in which unmarked grave they buried her or wherever they scattered her incinerated remains, she would find her way to the river. She would find her way to her sister. She waited in her cage, and thoughts of death sustained her. At the end of the third month, the women were moved into the camps. The ones who had put up no resistance were issued white uniforms and taken to Camp Thursday, where they were allowed the privileges of communal living. Others were dressed in blue and taken to solitary cells in Camp Friday or Camp Saturday. Some of the women spoke of another place, Camp Sunday. The stories they told of that place struck Surratt as the stuff of depraved medieval fantasy. And at first, she didn't believe the camp existed. After 3 days in Camp Thursday, they took her to her first visitation. She was led to a small complex of prefabricated offices, unmarked save for cameras hanging from the ceiling. The walls were plain and reinforced to keep the sound from traveling. She was ordered to sit on a small metal chair next to a metal table. Her arms were chained to the arms of the chair and her ankles to shackles in the floor. Soon the guards were gone and the room was quiet. She sat alone for 3 hours. A fire began to grow along her spine. She tried to shift her position, but the chair was bolted in place, and no movement of her neck could keep her muscles from seizing. The door opened. A short woman, about 10 years Surratt's senior, came in. She was dressed like the women who worked for the government in Atlanta. She folded her suit jacket and placed it gently on the table. She sat down.
"We know exactly what you did, Sarah Chestnut."
It was only then that Surratt realized her captors had no idea what she did. Not only because the woman had called her by her old first name, the one she'd abandoned so many years ago, but also because if the Blues had known about her crimes, there would be no need for an interrogation, no need to extract any confession. They knew nothing. Perhaps they'd apprehended her on some vague suspicion after seeing her visit the United Rebels compound. Perhaps she was simply a part of some random sweep, a fishing expedition.
"If you talk now, if you tell us everything and give us the names of the people you worked with, I might still be able to help you," said the woman.
She leaned slightly forward.
"There's still time, Sarah. There's still a chance for you to leave this place, to go back to Simon and to Dana, to do the right thing. All you have to do is be honest with me. Can you be honest with me, Sarah?
I didn't do nothing, said Surratt. The woman closed her eyes for a moment and shook her head.
Sarah, she said, I know you think I'm your enemy, but I'm here to help you. My bosses in Columbus, they want to lock you up forever. They want to keep you from ever seeing your home again. They look at you, and this is all they see.
From her briefcase, the woman produced a set of glossy photographs. She fanned them on the table. The photographs were of wreckage, the charred husk of a car torn apart. For a moment, Sarah thought the pictures were of her sister's death. But that couldn't be. The scenery was different, and the woman didn't even seem to know Dana was dead. She saw gutted sandbags strewn about, the remains of a checkpoint. In one of the pictures, the fortified center of the northern capital hovered in the distance. The confusion on Surratt's face must have been evident, because the woman quickly put the photos away.
Of course I know you didn't do this, Sarah, but this is what my bosses see, she said. But I told them, just give me a chance. I can talk to her. I read your file, Sarah. I know you've been through some terrible tragedy. And I know you wouldn't want innocent people, in the South or the North, to go through the same thing.
The woman looked over her shoulder, as though to check that no one was within earshot.
You know, my grandparents come from Alabama, she said. I guess you can say I've got the South in my blood. I know these values mean something to you, Sarah, protecting the weak, telling the truth, doing what's right. What's right? I want to go back to my bosses in Columbus, Sarah, and I want to be able to tell them what I know to be true, that you're not a bad person, that you don't have the blood of innocent people on your hands. And if I tell them that, they'll listen to me, and they'll send you home. And you can be with Dana and with Simon again in Lincolnton. I can help you, Sarah, but I need you to help me.
I didn't do nothing, said Surratt. Some of the softness dissipated from the woman's face. Her voice, once soothing, hardened.
You know, some of the people you're protecting, we already caught them, she said. They're right here, in this place, and they've already told us about you. They've already turned on you to save themselves. Do you really want to see them go free while you spend the rest of your life in a cell?
I didn't do nothing, said Surratt.
Albert Gaines told us about you, the woman said.
The mention of the name caused an involuntary twitch in Surratt, but she said nothing.
That's right, the woman continued. Albert Gaines gave you up. He told us you're an insurrectionist. Do you want us to believe him, Sarah? Do you want us to treat you the way we treat insurrectionists?
I didn't do nothing, said Surratt. The woman shook her head once more and rose from her seat.
This can be easy, Sarah, or this can be hard. The choice is yours.
I didn't do nothing, said Surratt. The woman left the room. Soon, a masked guard appeared. Even before he removed his mask, Surratt recognized him by his frame and by the thickness of his neck. Some of the guards were always careful never to show their faces to the detainees, but this one did not seem to care. He drew close and looked at her with hollow, contemptuous eyes. Before she could turn her head, he slapped her across the face. Her head snapped, but the rest of the body, chained in place, did not move.
"You dumb red dyke," said Bud. "We're gonna make you sing."
The soldier called a pack of four others into the room. They wore blue gloves and had covered faces and were made larger by the shells of their armor.
"Take her to the light room," said Bud.
She was transferred to a room in the basement of another building. The room was made of concrete and was empty save for two anchors bolted to the ground. A set of large white floodlights covered the entirety of the wall opposite the anchors. The guards chained Surratt's ankles to her wrists and both to the anchors in the floor, such that she was forced into a deep and immobilizing squat. The guards left the room, and for a moment, nothing happened. Then the floodlights came alive with a loud electric pop, and the room was drowned in eviscerating whiteness. Surratt closed her eyes. The white light now turned a hot red against her eyelids. She lowered her head, and for a while the onslaught was bearable. But soon the room began to grow warmer. Sweat dripped from her skin. Her knees burned with the weight of her body. On the third day, the door opened. A masked guard stepped forward and dropped a bowl of food and another of water on the ground where Surratt was shackled. The bowls were made of a soft rubber, and half their contents spilled on the floor where they landed. The guard left, and the door swung closed. One bowl contained a thin brown gruel speckled with white flakes. Unable to move her arms, Surratt struggled to get at the food. She grasped at it with her fingers and leaned as far forward as she was able. Feebly, she tossed it toward her mouth. The gruel tasted sulfuric, rotten. But she wolfed it down, deranged with hunger. Soon, her jumpsuit and the ground surrounding her were splattered with remnants of the meal. Under the heat of the floodlights, the gruel began to decompose. Every other day, the guard returned and dropped two bowls on the ground. By the tenth day, the throbbing in her head and her knees consumed her. The room filled her with shrieking, and the small red darkness she lived in while her eyes were closed now seemed to exist even when her eyes were open. On the 20th day, the guards removed her. In the visitation room, the woman in the neatly pressed suit asked Surratt if she'd had a change of heart.
"I didn't do nothing," said Surratt,
slumped in her shackling chair. The woman stood and left the room. Soon Bud returned. In the fog of her damaged vision, he seemed to move in place, blurry as a half-remembered dream. He grabbed her by the fuzz of hair that had grown back on her skull during her time in captivity.
"How do you think this is going to end?"
asked the guard, his breath hot on the side of her face.
"Do you think this ends with you winning? With us giving up? You're going to sing. I promise you."
He let her go and called the guards back in.
"Take her to the sound room," he said.
In the months between visitations, Surratt lived in a cell in Camp Saturday. The cell was square, and standing in its middle with her arms outstretched, Surratt could brush all four walls with her fingers. The walls were of concrete and were painted the color of margarine. A metal cot and a metal toilet bowl occupied opposite ends of the cell. Otherwise, it was bare. An overhead light shone at all hours of the day and night, erasing the difference between them. Deprived of the cycle of the day, and in time, the seasons, the mind made do with the only indicator of passing time available to it, the footsteps of the guards outside. The guards walked up and down the corridors of Camp Saturday at all hours. Every 3 minutes, the slit in Surratt's cell door would open, and a pair of eyes would inspect the room, and then the slit would close again. In time, the sound of metal slits opening and closing all along the corridor became a kind of metronome, against which Surratt measured the dawn and death of the day. Eventually, she came to know the peering eyes by heart and gave their owners names of her own invention. Sometimes, she heard screams from the nearby cells. Sometimes the women waited on a guard to open the slit in the door and then tried to throw cupped handfuls of shit and piss in their eyes. A few minutes later, a small troop of masked guards would rush the agitator's cell, and the woman would be carried kicking and screaming to the non-compliance area. In a week or two, she would return, and no more noises would come from her cell. The woman in the cell next to Surratt's was named Elena. She was from Mississippi and had lost her mind. Softly, she spoke to Surratt through the concrete, in a voice that passed so clearly through the wall that for months Surratt believed it to be a fabrication of her own torture-fevered brain. Elena said she had been born in this place, caged here from birth, because the Blues knew her to be a terrorist from the day she entered the world. She said Sugarloaf had once rested on a vast outcropping of land and was free of cages and free of fences. She sang songs about alligators and swamps and talking rodents.
Amidst the shuffling of the guards' feet and the rambling screams of the women, Surratt listened to her neighbor's voice the same way she listened to her own breathing, passively, without thought. But at other times, it was the only thing she could hear, a reminder she was still alive. Sometimes, Surratt talked back to the voice sliding softly through the walls, and in these times, she lied. When Elena asked her where she came from, she said South Carolina, and invented an elaborate lie about her escape from the illness unleashed upon that state. She enjoyed lying to her faceless neighbor, and enjoyed that the neighbor seemed to believe it. During the worst of her visitations, when after weeks of mistreatment she returned to her cell hallucinating with pain, it provided some small comfort to retreat into a wholly fabricated existence. Still, she resisted. The visitations came in waves. Sometimes the woman in the neatly pressed suit didn't come to see her for months at a time, until Surratt allowed herself to believe that perhaps the interrogations had finally come to an end. Sometimes the woman seemed a permanent resident of the island and would call on Surratt almost daily. Weeks alone in the rooms of sound and light dulled her senses, until the world beyond arm's reach became a muddled nimbus she could no longer decipher. The positions in which they shackled her slowly wore the cartilage from her knees and warped her back into a curving column of pain. Still, she resisted. In her third year on the island, Surratt participated in a hunger strike. Elena said women from every camp were taking part, refusing to eat or drink anything but water. She said some women had already been doing it for weeks. She said one had even died from it. A suicide of sorts, something the guards called going asymmetric. She said the women had a list of demands, chief among them, freedom. Failing that, they wanted their loved ones flown in to visit, lawyers from the Red to represent them, and the right to something whose name sounded foreign to Surratt's ears. She assumed it to be a drug or a religious text. The women in the solitary cells demanded time in the communal yard, a chance to see the sun. Surratt made no demands. She could no more imagine negotiating better treatment from her captors than negotiating the stinger away from a scorpion. Her silence was the only weapon they could not pry from her. To hand it to them in the form of hopeless appeals seemed to her an act of high cowardice, a tacit admission that the brutal kinetics of Sugarloaf obeyed some kind of law. For the same reason, she refused to meet the ones they called humanitarian envoys, who swooped in on Sugarloaf every few months with looks of stern disapproval plastered on their faces. For the same reason, she spat in the face of the woman with the neatly pressed suit. For the same reason, she tore the pages of the one book they allowed her and glued them with smeared shit to the slit of her cell door. For the same reason, Surratt made no demands. Instead, she simply refused to eat. In starvation, she took the levers of torture out of her torturer's hands and placed them in her own. In starvation, she found agency, control. A week into her strike and concussed with hunger, she was taken by the guards to the medical facility. She was led into a room with high white ceilings. Black sheets covered the windows and muted the sunlight. The room smelled familiar to Surratt. It was the smell of rubbing alcohol. She remembered the last time she saw her sister. A single cot, raised to the incline of a dentist's chair, stood in the center of the room. Laid out on a steel table nearby were a set of hypodermic needles, a coiled rubber tube, a box of disposable gloves, and two bags of clear fluid. The guards lifted her onto the bed. She felt straps tighten around her wrists and around her ankles and around her chest. Vice-like restraints locked her gaze to the white, empty ceiling. At the edge of her periphery, she saw one of the soldiers standing at the table. He wore a white coat and a stethoscope around his neck, but she knew he was a soldier.
He uncoiled the rubber tube and affixed it to one of the fluid bags, which he then attached to a metal stand. She watched out of the corner of her eye as he began applying a glistening, mucus-like substance to the end of the rubber tube, before Bud, the guard, stopped him.
"No need for that," Bud said. "She's a big, strong girl."
Amidst the convulsions that followed, they fed her. The white ceiling to which her eyes were locked began to fill with brilliant stars. The cot shook. She felt the hands of the guards holding her in place. The acidic aftertaste of the feeding fluid crawled up her throat and leaked out her slack mouth. It tasted of her insides. Midway through the feeding, a gust of wind sheared the black sheet from one of the windows. A beam of sunlight entered the room. Surratt closed her eyes and felt the warmth that grazed the very ends of her toes. Faintly, very far away, she heard the sound of children playing. For 3 days in January, a storm rattled the island. The rain made a sound like the patter of huge insects crawling on the prison walls. The women huddled and screamed in their solitary cells. The storm spared Surratt her daily feeding. Hunger returned this time as mercy. On the fourth day, her cell door opened, and Bud came inside. He arrived with the usual entourage of guards, but he made them wait outside. He closed the cell door behind him. She knew it was him before he appeared, the meter of his steps down the hallway a fingerprint. It amazed her sometimes how much she knew about a man she was supposed to know nothing about, the way his cheeks reddened when he cursed her, as though the sound of his own voice infuriated him, the way his upper lip drew closer to his nostrils in a feigned expression of disgust whenever he told a lie. She knew him the way animals know the weather, and from some indefinable thing living in the very presence of him, she'd learned to divine the severity of impending storms. But today she could not read him. There was a calmness about his hollow eyes, the veins of his neck untensed. She detected in his stocky face the expression of a child on the eve of Christmas, impatient and electric with anticipation. He sat at the foot of the bed. Instinctively, Surratt recoiled. She smelled the mess tent breakfast on him, the smell of fryer oil. He looked at the place by the bed where Surratt's last trickle of vomit had dried into a sand-colored crust. He chuckled.
"Tell me, do you believe any of that Hindu shit?" he said. "They got a book about it in the library here. Got so bored one night I started reading it. You believe any of that stuff about coming back as a toad or an ant or something if you were real bad in your last life? I mean, I saw what you did with that Bible we gave you. I know you're no Christian, so maybe you believe in that stuff."
Surratt said nothing. Bud cracked his knuckles. She waited for the cheeks to redden, the vein to emerge, and she readied her mind to take her to a faraway place.
"I've been thinking about that for a while now," Bud said, "because I got to thinking I must have done some real terrible shit in my last life. Burned down an orphanage or something. That's gotta be why I ended up here, stuck playing babysitter to a cage full of goddamned animals."
The slit in the doorway opened. A guard looked inside. Bud waved him away. In that moment, Surratt imagined lunging at his sweat-glistened neck, digging into the skin with her teeth. But what her mind imagined, her body no longer had the strength to do. And when again he turned to her and put his hand on her knee, she spat in his direction, but what came out was spittle.
"But see, then I got to thinking, I couldn't have done anything too bad, right?" said Bud. "I couldn't have done anything too bad, because then I would have come back as you."
He patted her softly on the knee, and then he stood.
"Remember when you first got here?" he asked. "Remember how you used to press your face against the cage like a dog, trying to get a look at the water? Well, guess what, Sarah Chestnut? We're gonna take you to the water."
She was moved by the guards to a different place, a small building she had never seen before. The building was white and unmarked. It stood at the edge of a fenced and barricaded complex that resembled Camp Saturday, but was much smaller. The complex lay near the edge of the island. As the guards led her inside, Surratt could hear the distant crashing of waves. They took her to a windowless room, lit harshly by the halo of an old, pre-war incandescent. The bulb hung on a string from a low white ceiling. Just as in the place where they fed her, a cot stood in the center of the room. The same people were present. Soldiers in guard uniforms and soldiers in white coats. But this time, the ones in guard uniforms stood near the cot, and the soldiers in the white uniforms stood in the periphery of the room. When Surratt looked at them, they looked away. Once again, she was strapped in place, and although she caught no sight of the usual implements on the bedside table, she closed her eyes and waited to be fed. But instead, she felt a sheet of soft cloth laid upon her face, and then she heard the voice of the woman in the neatly pressed suit.
"If you want this to stop, Sarah," the voice whispered, "you'll cooperate."
The voice went away. The room turned silent. And then Surratt was drowning. The water moved, endless. She entered and exited death, her body no longer hers. Spasms of light and heat encased her, the mind seized with fear and panic. She drowned, yet death would not come. It was in this way her captors finally broke her. To end the drownings, she admitted to all the crimes with which they charged her. Complicity in all manner of insurrectionist violence, things she'd never heard of before. She admitted her role in the killing of 3 blue informants in the New Fourth Ward and in a car bombing on the outskirts of Columbus. When asked about insurgents she knew, she said all she knew. When asked about those she didn't, she made up plausible lies. The woman in the neatly pressed suit presented to her reams of written confessions, and she signed every page. There was no lie too big that her fear of drowning couldn't make it true. The months that followed brought relief. Slowly, she was allowed the small, precious things previously denied her. Packets of soap and shampoo, books other than the Bible, black shades to block the overhead lights, spider venom painkillers to dull the screaming of her knees and her back. For an hour a day, she was led into the recreation yard, where she lay on the warm concrete at the foot of the fence and took in the sunlight, content as a house cat. They brought her food, and she ate it all, voracious. The food was fatty and bland. Soon, she began to gain weight, because there was little to do but sit in her cell and eat. But she ate every bite, and they never had to force feed her again. Every other Friday, when the guards came to cut her nails and trim her hair, she sat still and let them. And on the Thursdays before they came, when her nails were longest, she dug them deep into the skin of her inner thighs until she felt the warm trickle of blood. The guards who looked in on her every few minutes must have thought she was masturbating. They let her be. The following summer, the guards rotated, and Bud Baker left for good. But it didn't matter one way or the other to Surratt when Elena whispered the news through the cell block walls, because the girl whose soul the thick-necked guard had slowly strangled was also gone. The day assimilated the dark. The dark assimilated the day. Years passed. One day, long after her last visitation, 2 guards came to Surratt's cell and took her back to the old building in which she had confessed. As she was led down the hallway, she recognized the place, but it felt dilapidated, unused. There was now a fine layer of dust on the chairs and on the table. An old handwritten sign on one of the walls read, "Clean up after yourself." Once again, they sat her down, but this time, the guards did not shackle the prisoner to the bolts in the ground. The soldiers left, and soon a woman Surratt had never seen before entered the room. The woman was young and dressed in a formal blouse and skirt. Surratt was gripped with a cold, crippling fear at the sight of her new visitor. She stared mute and motionless at the woman, and quietly she resolved to herself that if they tried to take her once more to that small white room, she would claw her own throat out before she let them strap her again to the drowning chair. The woman sat down and set a plain folder on the table.
Sarah T. Chestnut?
Surratt said nothing.
Are you Sarah Chestnut?
The woman asked again.
That's your name, yes?
Surratt nodded. The woman removed from the folder three small stacks of stapled sheets.
Sarah, my name is Gabrielle, said the woman. I'm a repatriation specialist with the Peace Office in Columbus. I want you to listen carefully. Are you listening? To what I'm going to tell you, because this is important, all right?
Surratt nodded. The woman had a sing-song voice, a cadence fit for explaining things to children.
I'm going to ask you to read and sign these three forms, Gabrielle said.
As soon as she said it, Surratt began signing the papers.
Hold on, hold on. Let me tell you what they are, said the woman. Now pay attention. The first one is a declaration from the Peace Office. It states that the government of the United States, in capturing and temporarily detaining you as a suspected insurrectionist, was acting in good faith on information from a source the government now believes was not credible. It further states that, upon review, your status has been changed to no longer combatant. The second form is an agreement of indemnity covering all branches and arms of the United States government in perpetuity. The third form is a solemn declaration that you will not engage in any action nor counsel any action against any branch or arm of the United States government nor any of its members or representatives.
Surratt looked from the woman to the forms and back.
What do you want me to do? She asked.
The woman leaned across the table. She took Surratt's hands in her own. The sensation of a stranger's bare skin on hers felt alien to Surratt. The sensation of proximity without violence felt alien.
Sarah, the war is over, said Gabrielle. You're going home.
She heard the words, but they failed to register in her mind. Three times the woman repeated herself, until finally Surratt pushed her hands off and retreated from her chair to the corner of the room. There, she knelt into a fetal ball and would not look at the woman or listen to anything else she had to say. Soon, Gabrielle, exasperated, left the room, and the guards came in and dragged Surratt back to her cell. A few days later, they returned and took her again. But this time, it was not to one of the visitation buildings, but to the airstrip. There, she was made to board a small plane alongside a group of 14 women. The women looked haggard and disoriented in the glare of the early morning sun and said nothing to one another as they boarded the plane. Soon they were flying. From her small porthole window, Surratt peered out at the vast expanse of glittering blue surrounding the place that had been her prison. Her eyes badly damaged, she had trouble making out the geography over which the small plane flew, but she knew exactly what it was. The lapping Florida Sea, its bed thick with carpets of seagrass and schools of blind lionfish. It was real, even though she could not see it clearly, and would remain real even if every last pair of eyes in the world went blind. The plane crossed the sea and descended upon the mainland. Surratt was coming home.
Excerpted from Found Cause, Diary of a Former Southern Recruiter.
Some of the other ones would try all kinds of silliness. I knew one who would take them out to the middle of nowhere in the dead of the night and have them lie in open graves. He'd tell them, "This is where you're going to end up, trapped forever in a black hole in the ground, unless you fight for the cause of your people. The Lord takes good care of those who fight for the cause of their people." And that sort of thing was just fine if you were trying to get some burnout from the southern coast to put on a farmer suit, but a lot of the smarter ones saw right through it. What I found worked best was a lie slipped in with the truth. What I'd do is tell them about all sorts of terrible things the Blues had done. Show them pictures of the victims from the firebombing at Burleson, the massacre at Patience, things like that. But along with those things, I'd tell him about the slaughter at Pleasant Ridge. Now, the funny thing is, not once, in all my years working for the Rebel South, did any recruit bother to find out if there had ever been a slaughter at Pleasant Ridge. They just assumed it to be true. The Blues had done so much to our people. Why couldn't they have done that, too? After a while, even I couldn't remember if there had been a slaughter at Pleasant Ridge. That's what made it so easy to lie later on, too, when the Blue Surge came and they rounded us all up for interrogation. They wanted names and crimes, and we gave them both in droves. One guy I knew just listed off everyone who worked on his old block. A week later, the incursion force went and rounded up a bunch of accountants and butchers and grocery store clerks. Eventually, it got to be that the Blues had so much unreliable information on their hands, they had to let all those people go. But it was like a snake eating its own tail. By the time they got around to emptying those detention camps, they'd already turned most of the people there into exactly what they needed them to be in the first place. I always said the camps of Sugarloaf were the best recruiters the South ever had.
4. January 2095. Lincolnton, Georgia. Chapter 13. I remember the day I first met her. The day she invaded my life. There was an iron gate that bordered our property, its entrance at the crossroads where the road met the winding driveway that led to the house. My mother had the gate built after she found out she was pregnant. She also paid the contractors to add another foot of concrete to the seawall. She even had them put in a smaller picket fence around the house itself, a moat that split us from the greenhouses and the rest of the property. My father said it was overkill. Babies aren't made of glass. But my mother, who had once given up hope of ever having a child of her own, insisted. My father said some nights she used to stay up till sunrise, imagining all the ways that fate and the devil conspired to take her only child. The two arms of the gate were decorated with twisting, curling bars that, when the gate closed and the two arms met, formed a metal outline of a pineapple. Near the entrance stood an old-fashioned mailbox, an antique from the days of government mail. A decorative wooden plaque atop the mailbox read, Corina and Simon Chestnut. Once, when my father was in his clouded place, he forgot to hit the clicker as the car approached the gate and accidentally drove right into it. There wasn't much damage. He never drove very fast, and none of us were hurt, but my mother asked him not to take the car out again after that. Most days he was fine, and in regular conversation, you'd never be able to guess the damage that had been done to him. But my mother said you just couldn't tell when the clouds would come over him and he'd retract from the world. Even a pristine mind can fog over, let alone one hurt that way. You just couldn't tell. There was a buzzer in the grand room downstairs that went off whenever the gate opened. My mother, sick of the sharp sound it made, had recently ordered it altered to emit a prettier ring, two soft chimes, followed by a faint rustling, like the sound of leaves in a breeze. On the night the stranger arrived, I heard the chimes. I climbed out of bed and ran downstairs. My father was standing on the front steps. At the foot of our home, the driveway ended in a circle around my mother's rose garden. The roses were a pale pink. It was said by many a visitor that no such flower grew anywhere else in the South. The magic that encircled the chestnut's place sustained them. I stood near my father and watched the car approach. It was the middle of winter. I was 6 years old. I still remember.
You should be in bed, my father said. You'll give your mother trouble tomorrow if you don't get your sleep.
But I pleaded, and he was too distracted by the looming car and our new guest to argue. I hid behind his leg and peered out, fascinated by the arrival of this stranger about whom my parents had argued for weeks. The car pulled up to the house. The asphalt was newly laid and the wheels crunched against it. When my mother came out of the car, she looked exhausted. I'd seen her this way before, the previous winter when Zenith came through and devastated the greenhouses. The house, made of fine red brick, withstood the storm, but
Throughout the property, there were shards of glass, solar panels twisted and cracked. For 5 days straight, she worked with the laborers to repair the damage. I remember seeing that drained look on her face. It was in those moments when I think she secretly wished my father was well enough to help her, that his mind was healed enough not just to carry on pleasant conversation, but to hold important things in memory, to keep from wandering to his clouded place. Sometimes, when I refused to go to bed or played in the parts of the yard that were off limits, my mother would yell at me. It felt then like she was yelling twice at the same time, once for whatever I'd done, and again because she was mad that it was always her who had to do the yelling. The passenger door opened, and from the car unfurled a huge, hunched body. The enormity of it blocked out the light from the driveway lamp, and for a moment, all I saw of her was a limbed wall of blackness. "Welcome home, Surratt," my mother said. The stranger moved slowly out of the light. My father descended the porch steps. He looked confused, his eyes squinting as though he were trying to focus on a very faraway thing.
"For God's sake, Simon," said my mother. "Don't you remember your own sister? Come here and give her a hug."
My father stepped forward and hugged her. She tightened up at the feel of his arms around her and did not reciprocate. When he pulled away from her, my father had tears in his eyes, but the stranger looked at him in a way I'd never seen before. There was a kind of vicious longing in her eyes, a recollection of something once tender, now poisoned. She looked at him as though he were a plaster mask of her own face, cast before the onset of some great deformity. I ran in for a closer look at our visitor. I hid behind my mother's skirt.
"Benjamin, this is Surratt,"
she said, pulling me out from behind her.
"This is your aunt."
I stared at the towering woman, dumbstruck. I had seen a picture of her once. In the picture, she must have been a teenager, lean and bald-headed, a menacing smile on her face. But what stood in our driveway bore almost no resemblance to that image. This woman was fat, her gut pressed against her dirty gray shirt, but it was more than that. All of her seemed oversized, her limbs trunk-like, her nose flattened and wide. She looked old. I'd been told she was my father's younger sister. She was not even 30 years old. But she looked older than him, older than my mother even. As a child, I imagined there were only three ages anyone could be, young like me, old like my parents, or very old like my grandparents in the north or the women in black dresses who came to see my father. But this woman was none of these things. My mother ushered me toward our guest. I waited for her to lift me, to hug me and pinch my cheeks the way all our visitors did. Rarely did anyone come by the house without a present for me. The very old women in the black dresses, who called me the miracle of the miracle, would often take me aside and give me crisp $100 bills. But this visitor did nothing. Not knowing how to respond, I hugged her leg. She stood motionless. I felt my mother lift me up.
"It's past his bedtime," she said. "I'm gonna take him upstairs. Come in, Surratt. Come in."
Our guest looked at the house as though it were made of thorns.
"Whose is this?"
she asked.
"It's ours, Surratt," said my mother. "It's yours. We tore the old one down a few years ago when things got better after..."
She paused.
"Come on in."
But she was looking elsewhere. To the eastern edge of the property, where the seawall curled south past three greenhouses and the broken old shed.
"Why is that wall there?"
she asked.
"The levee? We put that in around 91,
my mother said.
"Used to be the river would flood and wreck the greenhouses 3-4 times a year."
"The river don't run that way," our guest said. "That's land for another 10 miles. I used to walk out there."
"Surratt, the river moves," said my mother. "It ate all that land a long time ago."
I thought I caught a twinge flash across her face, but quickly it was gone. She seemed to dismiss our home entirely. Everyone always said there was no finer piece of property in all of northern Georgia than the Chestnuts place, but she barely noticed it at all.
"We got a room for you already," said my father. "It's a nice room."
He looked at my mother, who nodded.
"That's right, a nice room,"
my mother said.
"I think you'll like it, Surratt. It has a view of the river, just like your old room did."
Our guest seemed to retract slightly at the mention of the river, as though some primal mechanism of defense, deep within her, had been triggered. I had no idea then of what water had done to her. She pointed at the old shed.
"I'll stay in there," she said.
"Surratt,"
my mother pleaded.
"There's nothing in there but old glass panels and leftover wood. Come inside."
"I'll be fine in there."
I saw my mother look at my father, who seemed not to find our visitor's request at all unreasonable. I wondered if he even heard what she said, or if he had drifted to his clouded place.
"All right, Surratt,"
my mother said.
"Wherever you're most comfortable. We'll bring the spare bed out from the basement, and some sheets."
"No," she said. "It's fine as it is." And then she was walking past the rose bush to the shed I'd only ever seen the gardener use to store his mower. I watched her move. She shuffled on stiff knees, the soles of her feet barely lifting. She reminded me of my pet turtle, every step a pained, deliberate undertaking. I wanted to stay up all night and see whether she would really sleep in that leaning, weathered shed, but my mother ordered me back to bed. My bedroom faced the rose garden in the driveway. The eastern side of the house obstructed my view of the shed. My bedroom window, which my mother always kept locked, made faint the humming of the solar panels and the sound of the river. But I lay awake in the dark, listening. Not long after our guest disappeared into the shed, there came from the place a loud cracking noise, like the structure itself was coming undone. Eventually I heard my parents whisper arguing about it. I couldn't make out any of the words, but I could always tell when they argued. It was something in the sharpness of the sounds, but only the ones from my mother's mouth. I'd never known my father to be anything but tranquil, his keel perfectly even, no matter the situation. The way other grown-ups treated him, alternating between overt gestures of sympathy and barely suppressed impatience, made it seem as though he was not supposed to be this way, that there was a fault, a failing deep within the workings of him. But in my eyes, he was simply kind. I heard my mother go down the stairs. I heard the front door open and close. Many years later, when her letter led me to the place of her buried memories and I read the pages she left behind, I learned all about the moments that filled in the blanks between those things I'd witnessed with my own eyes, and by the time I was done reading, I'd learned every last secret my aunt had to give. Some people are born sentenced to a terrible inheritance, diseases that lay dormant in the blood from birth. My sentence was to know, to understand. My mother went to the shed. Inside, she found our visitor tearing the floorboards from the ground.
"What are you doing, Surratt?"
"I want to sleep on the soil," she said. "Go back inside, Karina."
"All right, that's fine,"
my mother said.
"Do you want some help? I think we have a crowbar or something in one of the greenhouses."
"I'm fine. Go back inside."
My mother ran her finger along the underside of the upturned planks resting against the wall. The wood was filthy and bleached, a faint green from years pressed against the soil.
"You remember back when you first hired me to take care of the old house?"
my mother said.
"You sat me down, and you went through this long list you'd written of all the things I couldn't do. Don't go near the shed. Don't go near the cellar. Don't open the boxes those boys on the boats deliver. Don't wake Miss Dana when she's asleep."
My mother paused.
"Anyway, I remember when you were finally done. I didn't know if there was anything left for me to do. Only thing you never said not to do was take care of that brother of yours. Guess I've been doing that ever since."
Our guest looked up from where she knelt on the floor.
"How much of him is left?"
"You don't have to say it that way, Surratt," How much of him is left?
He has plenty of good days, my mother said.
He has plenty of really good days, when you wouldn't even know it. Sometimes he gets lost in himself a little. Sometimes he has trouble remembering new things. A few times he'll forget old things. But he's not... he's good.
Our guest stared at my mother, unflinching. Then she returned to ripping the boards from the floor.
When I woke the next morning, she was still in her shed. I sat on the steps of the kitchen door and waited for her to come out, half convinced the image of her in my head from the night before was the doing of some strange dream. Inside, my mother and father sat at the counter.
It's coming up on noon, my mother said.
Just let her sleep, Karina, my father replied. It's her first night out of that place in 7 years.
It's not sleep I'm worried about. How do you know she hasn't?
My mother caught sight of me on the steps.
How do you know she hasn't done something?
My father stood and kissed my mother on the forehead. I knew she hated when he did that during their arguments, as though it were some kind of counterpoint to whatever she had to say.
It's going to take a long time, he said.
Fine, my mother replied.
But I'm not cooking a second breakfast. She wakes up now, she wakes up at midnight, she gets this.
A plate sat on the kitchen counter, piled with fried eggs fresh from the coop my mother kept near the rows of our numbered greenhouses, as well as asparagus from House 6 and strips of real Virginia bacon.
Fair enough, my father said. I'm not asking you to wait on her. Just treat her as if she was your family.
That's not fair.
I could see my mother getting angry. She had a habit of digging her thumbnails into the skin of her middle fingers when her patience stretched.
I married you, didn't I? She is my family.
My father recoiled a little, surprised that my mother had taken offense. He was least clouded at the start of the day, least likely to forget or repeat himself, but most often he suffered from an inability to predict how the things he said sounded to ears other than his own.
I'll take it to her, I said, stepping into the kitchen.
My parents looked at me, and then each other.
Sure, why not? Said my father. She's your aunt. Go ahead.
Triumphant, I took the plate. The kitchen counter was a buttercream marble veined with black, and I had just that year grown tall enough to reach it. On my way out, I took an oatmeal cookie from the jar on the table and set it on the plate. It seemed incomprehensible to me that so little food could possibly satisfy a body so big. At the shed, I found the doors slightly ajar. I wedged my hips between them and budged them open. Inside, the old pre-war bulb was still on. I could feel the heat of it, even though sunlight seeped in through 1,000 cracks in the wood. The air smelled of dust and mothballs and the wetness of recently disturbed earth. It also smelled of her. She was still sleeping, her frame curled into something like a question mark upon a space in the floor where there was no floor, as though the very foundations of the shed had backed away from her quietly in the night. She was snoring, and the thumb of her right hand twitched. As slow and quiet as possible, I set the plate on the workbench. An old black toolbox had been taken down from the shelves, a dust outline still visible in the place where it had sat unused for years. Its contents were strewn about, a screwdriver, a set of pliers, and a folding knife. The knife had a black aluminum handle engraved with initials I couldn't decipher. There were a few strands of hair on the blade. I was transfixed by the knife. At home, my mother would not let me near anything with a blade, not even the butter knives whose edges were dull as soap. But something about the confines of the old musty shed made me believe that this was a wild, sovereign place where my mother's rule had no power. I was so mesmerized by the rust-streaked blade on the workbench, I didn't notice when the snoring stopped. I heard something like a sharp inhale. I dropped the knife and turned to find her on her feet, moving faster than I ever thought possible for someone of such size, lunging. But it was not toward me. Like a frenzied prey, she darted away to the furthest corner from where I stood.
She backed into the walls with such force that the shed itself shook, and I thought the whole rotting thing would come down on us. Fear of her pulled me toward the door, but something kept me where I stood. I saw the rise and fall of her chest. She looked at me as though I had stingers for limbs.
"Breakfast," I blurted out.
"I brought you breakfast.
Look, look."
I pointed at the plate on the workbench, but she never took her eyes off me. Slowly, she approached. When she was close to me, she knelt down. She leaned in until her face was close to mine, and I could feel the milky breath of the newly woken on my cheek.
"I forgot your name," she said.
"Benjamin," I replied.
"My name's Benjamin Chestnut."
She took my chin in her hand and inspected my face.
"You look like your father did when he was young," she said. "You got none of your mother in you."
I saw that she had shaved her head and that there were fresh cuts on her scalp.
"Why do you want to sleep here?"
I asked.
"It smells funny. We have lots of nice rooms in the house. My parents say you can stay there as long as you want."
She let me go. Her eyes were red and her face stained on one side with soil. She wore the same clothes she had on when she arrived. It occurred to me then that not a single piece of clothing in our home would fit her.
"Listen very carefully to what I'm about to tell you," she said.
I nodded.
"Don't ever come in here again."
She didn't leave the shed until dinner time. In those days, whenever the weather wasn't too hot, my mother liked to have dinner in the backyard by the levee. We had a beautiful table on the deck, made of real Cascadia redwood, and although the levee blocked our view of the river, we were able to enjoy its breeze. My mother saw her in the yard.
"Come have some dinner, Surratt," she said. "It's a gorgeous night. Don't get too many of those anymore."
She looked at the old plot where my mother once planted her first seeds, back when she was still the help, still an interloper.
"Look familiar, don't it?"
my mother said.
"It's from before, from the old house. You remember how you used to get me that good foreign soil? That's all we use now, in all the greenhouses. That very same soil."
In the weeks that followed, we settled into routine. Our guest spent most of her days and nights in the shed. Sometimes she came outside and walked among the greenhouses, but only late in the evening when my parents were asleep. I lay awake some nights, looking for her out my window. Whenever I brought her meals to the shed and set them on the ground outside, I peeked in through the doors. I always saw her hunched over a table made of a plywood sheet on stacked paint can legs. The shed was littered with cheap paper diaries you could only still get from the last dead tree store in Lincolnton. She was writing in the old way. My mother said if she didn't want to be part of this family, it was best to just ignore her. But I couldn't. Whenever the old widows came by with toys for me, I made sure to play with them out in the backyard from a spot where I could see through the ajar shed doors. But nothing enticed her to notice me. She seemed to exist in her own wild space, unshackled from the rules and decorum of life as my parents had made me know it. It amazed me to think that she slept on soil and ate where she stood and had been on a trip to some secret place for 7 whole years. My sheltered world shook with the realization that it was possible to live this way. I'd been raised in the shadow of walls. She was of the river. We had fewer guests in the months after she arrived. The politicians who visited from Lincolnton and Atlanta stopped coming. But the old widows still came by every week like clockwork. Some of them wanted to see her, but she would never come to the house. Sometimes, playing in the paths between the greenhouses, I'd hear the laborers gossiping about her in their strange, far south drawl. They called her a blue nose and a pocket mouth, and I had no idea what those things meant. But the words sounded exotic, far away, primed with the stuff of adventure. Late that winter, a new visitor came. Through my bedroom window, I saw his small motorcade,
three busted sedans, the old kind that ran on illegal fuel, at the far gate of the driveway. When I came downstairs, I heard my mother say we shouldn't let a man like that anywhere near our home, that we should tell him to turn right around and go back wherever he came from. But my father said that would make us bad hosts. The cars came